Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arrest of seven princes in Saudi Arabia by MBS, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who, with the takeover of the Saudi National Guard, is completing a consolidation of his total control of the military after having already taken over Saudi foreign, economic and social policies and ministries. David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, joins us to discuss the Trump family role in this major shakeup of a corrupt ruling family with the arrest of the outspoken critic of Trump, the billionaire Prince Alawid bin Talal, following Jared Kushner's recent secret trip to the kingdom to meet with his new friend, MBS. We'll analyze the links between Trump's call on the Saudis for the Aramco IPO to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange, the sudden resignation of the Lebanese prime minister who fled to Saudi Arabia, and the missile attack on the airport in the Saudi capital launched from Yemen, and Iran's fingerprints on the missile attack, which has led to speculation that the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran is heating up. Then we look further into the sudden exit of Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, who announced his resignation on the Saudi Al-Arabiya channel, speaking from Riyadh, not Beirut. Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is the author of A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, joins us from Beirut, Lebanon, to discuss Hariri's claim that he was escaping an assassination planned by Hezbollah and how this crisis is impacting the already shaky political order in a country overwhelmed by refugees from the war next door in Syria. Then finally, we'll examine the new round of fratricide going on within the Democratic Party, prompted by the forthcoming book by former DNC chair Donna Brazil, Al Gore's campaign manager responsible for getting Joe Lieberman on the ticket as Gore's VP. David Halperin, a former policy advisor to Howard Dean's presidential campaign and a White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us. We will discuss the pantheon of prominent Democrats who have made careers out of losing campaigns and the possibility that the Democrats could lose Tuesday's critical race for governor in Virginia. And joining us now is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who formerly was a chief foreign leader, writer of The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief and European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hello, hi.
So thank you for joining us, David. And what do you make of this shakeup, and particularly the prominent role that Jared Kushner appears to have taken, at least in having a secret trip there that ended just a week ago Saturday, and President Trump himself conspicuously tweeting out urging the Saudis to list Aramco's IPO on the New York Stock Exchange. We know that the ousted prince, who is holed up in a luxury hotel, they're not exactly put in jail, but Alawid bin Talal is quite prominent, but he also is a very prominent critic of Donald Trump's. Back in 2005, he was pretty damning in his critique of Trump.
Yes, and recently I'm told by a reliable source that he refused to invest in NEOM, the megacity that MBS announced would be built, and that was one of the reasons for the fallout. But he's also been quite public, incurring the wrath of his cousin. These are all family members, and calling openly for another cousin's release, with the release of Mohammed bin Nayef, who was the strong man in control of the Ministry of Interior. So several things have happened, like bangs in the night in Riyadh on last night. The first thing that happened was the resignation of Saad Hariri in Riyadh, and we can talk about that a bit later. But it was an interesting place to announce a resignation of a prime minister in neighboring Lebanon. But also this wave of arrests and the significant arrests are the arrests of businessmen with literally billions of dollars worth of assets, which Mohammed bin Salman appears to have seized. One, Saudi Arabia needs the money, or their money anyway, and two, it's a bid for total control. If you actually analyze what MBS now heads, he heads the Economic Committee, which is the head of the privatization. He heads Aramco, which is still the world's largest oil company. He personally directs and is in charge of each of Saudi Arabia's three armies. That's the Defense Ministry, the Interior Ministry, and now he heads the National Guard because he's arrested the other prince who was in charge of it, Prince Meteb. And also, he heads a new committee that was announced yesterday after the arrests that stands really virtually above the law. In fact, it stands above the law by decree. It basically has the right to arrest, to seize assets of anyone in the kingdom and their assets outside the kingdom. And they can investigate their target outside the scope of the law. It actually says that in the decree, which is pretty hair-raising. I mean, there are a number of implications for this. This is the continuing rise of a 32-year-old prince who will shortly one day become king himself. That's the first thing. Same thing about the same story with the siege of the blockade of Qatar. He used it to gain more power. Well, he's done exactly the same thing this time around. It also sends an absolutely frightening message to any foreign investor. But thirdly, it appears to be done, and it's coming back to your question in a very long-winded way, it appears to, all of this appears to have happened with another green light from Donald Trump, who, as you say, tweeted that he'd very much appreciate Saudi Arabia doing their IPO of Aramco on the New York Stock Exchange. And he says it's important to the United States. But, of course, everything that happens with Aramco lacks transparency. And the one thing, of course, that they want to hide from the rest of the world, and certainly from the very strict rules of the New York Stock Exchange, is the amount of money that the royal family has creamed off Aramco. That's what they basically want to hide. They cannot give Aramco's true accounts. But by law, on the New York Stock Exchange, unless they bend it, that's what has to happen for investors to invest in 5%. So what we're seeing here is absolute chaos. No rule of law. First you announce the arrests, then you announce the creation of the committee who made the arrests. You seize people's money. You seize some of the money from some of the richest people. So it's a very, very risky process going on here because you imagine how furious the rest of the royal family is. Being stripped of their wealth. And you present yourself as a reformer to the West. It really, none of this adds up.
Well, clearly, Aramco has been the slush fund for the Saudi royals. They also get kickbacks from arms sales, which is how they justify their enormous wealth and why they buy so many weapons. But what's your sense then of this in the broader context, given the provocative missile attack on the airport in Riyadh coming from Yemen, and clearly with Iran's fingerprints, the exodus or the exit, sudden exit of Hariri claiming Hezbollah wanted to kill him, the general power that Iran or projection of power that Iran has now as it appears their proxy, both Hezbollah and the Assad family are winning pretty much in Syria. There's, you know, a sense that the long talked about Shia Crescent will become a reality with a corridor from Tehran through to Damascus. I can't help feeling that this is a big part of it, isn't it? This proxy war.
Well, just to try and simplify things and not go into too many issues at the same time. The wider sense of this is that, I mean, the first thing that happened yesterday was this resignation speech by Hariri. This is a very, very odd speech. And people studying it said it was a complete change of tone from the piece, from the quite optimistic tone that Hariri adopted about Hezbollah, and certainly about the government of which he headed for a year. When he left Beirut just a few days ago, he was confident enough to have selfies taken of him with airport workers. He left Lebanon in a sunny and optimistic mood. And just a few days later, he comes up with this very hardline speech, anti-Hezbollah, anti-Iran, saying he was the subject of an assassination threat. Certainly not the tone of what he was saying just a few days before. He met with a Saudi minister a few days before, the Saudi minister of Gulf Affairs, which went very well. And the two tweeted that they had many things of interest. But then suddenly the Saudi minister's tone changed rapidly after Hariri's resignation. And people are very, in Lebanon, the reaction was very bemused by all of this. And one of the most interesting things that was said today was by the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, who reacted very calmly to the news on Sunday. He put all the blame. He actually went immediately to Hariri's defense. This is very interesting to the point because, you know, Hariri was so anti-Hezbollah, but what Hezbollah was doing today on Sunday was to come to Hariri's defense. Nasrallah called the resignation a violation of Lebanese sovereignty, which was an attack on Hariri's dignity. He referred to Hariri as our prime minister, not our former prime minister. And he hinted that Hariri had been put under house arrest. I don't actually think that's the case. I hear from another source he hasn't been arrested. But it's a very interesting reaction from Hezbollah. It's in defense of Hariri. And all of these things point to the fact that Hariri was forced to make this statement by the Saudis, and it was made against his will. And that just a few days ago, he wasn't expecting to make it. He left Lebanon in a sunny and optimistic mood. So my conclusion from Hezbollah's reaction, from Iran's reaction as well, and also from my own sources in Saudi Arabia, are that Hariri was forced to make this resignation. We know, of course, in the past that he was heading Saudi Arabia's second largest construction company. We know that there was pressure on that construction company because it was bankrupt. The construction company's name is Saudi Ogar. Mohammed bin Salman, in other words, was forcing Hariri to return the cash. And then forced his resignation. Now, Hezbollah has refused to be refused to react to this, and the mood in Lebanon at the removal of their prime minister is one of calm, they have no intention of breaking up the government. But that was today. Something else may happen tomorrow, but it was it's a very interesting reaction. But as I say, the indications are that Hariri did not want to resign. He was forced to by the Saudis. Now, the second thing that happened on Saturday was the impact or arrival of a long-range missile aimed at the capital at Riyadh by the Houthis. Now, the Houthis have very sophisticated long-range missiles, but in the past, they have aimed them at Jeddah and Mecca, not at the capital in Riyadh. Now, they get their missile parts from Iran and from the technology, and there seems to be a message inherent in this, certainly from the Houthis, which was this: if you ramp up pressure on Hezbollah, we will ramp up pressure on you in Riyadh. Now, this missile was supposedly intercepted by air defense systems around Riyadh airport, but the fact that it had crossed thousands of miles to get there, it seems to be a big hit. And there are other reports coming from Riyadh that signs of panic and a fire near the airport. So whether the missile hit or whether debris hit around the airport, one simply cannot, we'll never be able to discover it. But there was a bump in the night there, certainly. all of these are indications of the regional instability that is really being generated by the future king of Saudi Arabia, both internally and externally. And we're in for a very, very bumpy time. Netanyahu also yesterday made a very bellicose speech about Iran. There appears to be a plan which has been coordinated through Kushner of ramping up the pressure on Iran at the moment. I think Hezbollah and Iran are all too aware of what's cooking at the moment, and they're trying to combat it. This is, an extremely dangerous moment. I'm still amazed that there are commentators out there from the West who are calling bin Salman a reformer and a young man in a hurry. That's certainly one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that he is accruing a huge amount of power and doing so in a very reckless and foolhardy way, incurring the right. He really is a 32-year-old now with absolute power in Saudi. And is this, for instance, what message does this, all of these moves, including the creation of a committee that can seize all your wealth, what message does this send to foreign investors? None of this stacks up. It's highly impulsive, very dangerous, and he's arrested very powerful rivals.
Well, I can't help seeing a kind of symmetry here between father and son, or in this case, father and son-in-law, with Kushner and Trump and King Salman and this 32-year-old impulsive young man, apparently out of his depth, started an ill-fated war in Yemen, and a boneheaded blockade of Qatar, and the extent to which Jared Kushner has given Trump bad advice, and Trump himself seems to have some, at least other, he's accused of having some mental instability. We know that King Salman has some form of dementia, but the idea that Jared advised Trump to fire the special prosecutor because he thought the Democrats would like it, I mean, is this a case of spoiled brats having too much power?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I'm no fan of the American deep state. It's made some terrific mistakes of its own, as indeed has Britain, over Iraq, invading Iraq, and all the consequences since then. But just put yourself in the position of Secretary Mattis or Secretary Tillerson right now and say, what words would they be using about Trump now? I mean, they probably wouldn't be broadcastable. But this is one holy mess that is being created. They're trying to calm things down. They're trying to douse the wild fires that have been lit by the assault on Qatar. And now suddenly the same group of people who are in charge of this campaign against Qatar, which is hosting an extremely important American base, are setting fire to Lebanon and provoking Hezbollah in a very, very big way. If you were in a position of firefighting, putting down fires and saying, let's coordinate, let's keep pressure up on diplomatic pressure up on Iran to coordinate a pushback, what would you think of these moves? And you'd literally be tearing your hair out.
Well, of course, the MBS situation extends, just in closing, beyond. It's also an alliance there with MBZ, the Mohammed bin, the leader of the Emirates, whose ambassador here in Washington, Tabor, is supposedly has taken over from the other eminence, the former Saudi ambassador, who was Bandar. And they're throwing money around, even hired Richard Clark, who was, of course, prominent in the 9/11 aftermath as on one of their front groups. So just in closing, is there a weird sort of wag the dog going on there between MBS and MBZ?
Yeah, completely. MBZ is basically MBS's mentor. He's behind the campaigning against Qatar. He also advises and is in close touch with the Trump family and with Steve Bannon as well, who continues to have good sources of information in the Gulf. And says some very interesting things, like 1,000 clerics have been arrested in Saudi Arabia. So yes, that this is all part of the same cabal. It's highly destabilizing. These guys have got a lot of money, and they are now really shaking the Gulf and its immediate environment apart. And this is in an area where everyone is highly armed, and where there are wars going on in Yemen, in Libya, Egypt is tottering, Syria has been destroyed, and will at best become a sort of Lebanon in about 10 years' time. Iraq, its major cities are in ruins. Just think about the scale of the destruction, the number of refugees, the number of people who are sitting in tents as we speak, as a result of 13 years of the war on terror, 14 years of the war on terror. And now this happens as well. So there's a continuing destabilization of the region going on. But this is coming from the very top of the leadership of the region. The richest country is Saudi Arabia. And by the way, reports are just coming in of the death in custody of another prince, Abdulaziz bin Fahd, who is 44. He puts people in prison, and then suddenly they die of a heart attack. So this is a really ruthless regime that is being set up in Saudi Arabia, and it is being done with this ruthlessness is being done with encouragement from the highest levels of a U.S. president who really doesn't know the chaos and havoc that his advisors are wreaking.
Well, David Hurst, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking further into the sudden exodus of the Prime Minister of Lebanon to Saudi Arabia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon, is Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy. His books include A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Thanasi. And David Hurst has suggested that people in Lebanon, where you are one, bemused by the sudden disappearance of their prime minister, who then shows up on Al Arabiya from Saudi Arabia. But he also went on to say that there's a speculation that the Saudis may have forced him into making that speech about his being targeted for assassination by Hezbollah. What's the local opinions on all of those questions?
Well, so people here were waiting for tonight's speech from Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and so was I, to make a judgment on how worried or alarmed to be. Nasrallah really sent out calming signals. He made a speech in which he ridiculed Hariri's resignation, in a very creative way, he basically said, look, we don't even hold him responsible for this. It was clear that the Saudis wrote the speech. It's clear that he's in some manner a hostage of Saudi Arabia. Otherwise, why would he have tarnished our national honor by resigning from there? So we're just going to talk about this with the Saudis. This isn't even a Lebanese issue. And that serves three purposes. One, it calms down people's worries. And I think after this speech, people are much less worried about this exploding. Secondly, it gives an opening for a resolution of tensions inside Lebanon with or without Hariri. And third, it really boxes in Hariri, who I think has been just an abysmal failure as a politician. Even, you know, if you agree or don't agree with what he's trying to do, he's been so weak and ineffectual, whether as an ally of the West, whether as a proxy of Saudi Arabia. He's just been slipping into the margins. And at this point, it seems like someone thought that his resignation would somehow be like a bomb that would go off in the center of Lebanese politics, destabilizing everything and somehow forcing the Iranian allied coalition to adjust. My suspicion is that they'll really just shrug it off. I mean, this country just went through 3 years with an interim prime minister, two of which there was no president. This was in the middle of the Syrian war. And somehow, despite a lot of gumming up of the works created by this vacuum at the upper levels, the country muddled through without breaking out into war or collapsing. And I think this is a problem, but not an emergency.
Well, clearly there's a proxy war going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and there's a peculiar alliance developing between Saudi Arabia and Israel. On Friday in Chatham House in London, Prime Minister Netanyahu said that there is much, much larger changes going on than any other period in Israel history. It's huge change. The good guys are getting together with Israel in a new way, forming an effective alliance to counter the aggression of Iran. Now, Israel's obviously looking at the fact that right next door, Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, and Assad have pretty much won that war. There's the Shia Crescent has become a reality with a land corridor from Tehran to Damascus. That's got to at least get their attention.
Tehran to the Mediterranean, through including Lebanon too, not just Damascus, right?
Right, exactly. Lebanon being, Hezbollah being pretty much the dominant political force there in Lebanon, aren't they?
Yeah, they're by far the strongest single party, and although they don't control the whole country or every aspect of the government, they're stronger than anybody else. I think you're right, Ian. This is the way to read all of this is in the context of this really unprecedented realignment going on. You touched on some of the forces at play. This is the transformation or the attempted transformation of Saudi Arabia by MBS, which you were talking about on the previous segment, is a big deal. I think their capability is limited. They're really a poor strategic actor. We see this in their failure in the war in Yemen. They're very damaging and murderous failure. But anyway, what's going on here is that Iran and its allies have done better, I think maybe even than they expected. They've consolidated their web of alliances in Iraq. They've won in Syria. They've really enshrined a dominant position of influence in Lebanon. This is, as you said, a major shift. It's been a big enough deal to make the Gulf monarchs more open than ever before about their de facto alliance with Israel. And they're going to try and lash back wherever they can. We need to bear a couple of things in mind when we see this. One is that they are really awful at coming up with effective ways to push back. So again, Exhibit A is the war in Yemen, or even the quashing of the popular uprising in Bahrain in 2011. They're very clumsy and blunt. They are used to winner takes all outcomes, and they don't know how to operate in spaces where, you know, like Lebanon, they used to be dominant here. Now Iran is dominant, but they still have, say, 40% of the power under their influence, and they don't know how to deal with that. So MBS's initial reaction was to throw a tantrum and walk away, canceled the billions of dollars of aid to the Lebanese army, cut off Hariri and bankrupted him, literally bankrupted the family construction company based in Saudi Arabia that made the Hariris the players they are, and then after a year had second thoughts, half-heartedly readopted Hariri, now has tried to use him in this way to influence Lebanese politics in a way that, again, is really self-sabotaging. I mean, if Hariri is going to be your proxy or your puppet or your ally, the last thing you should do is make clear that he has no independent power of his own and have him resign from Riyadh, right? That's not how Iran does it with its local allies and proxies, right? It makes them look strong. It doesn't make them look weak and manipulated. And to me, the danger here is not that that Saudi and America and Israel will push back. That's natural in a strategic contest. It's that they won't know how to do so intelligently and with effect, and that they'll be willing very easily and lazily to gamble with other people's lives and stability, so that Saudi Arabia won't think twice about starting a war in Yemen or starting a war in Lebanon, since it doesn't really touch them, and increasing parts of the region could burn while this coalition figures out once again that it really has lost to the Iranian coalition and can't do that much about it.
And of course, adding to your list of the stumbling on the part of MBS is the blockade of Gaza, which is going nowhere. And David Hurst listed all of the sort of this toxic brew going on with the MBZ and MBS's alliance with the Emirates and the Emiratis. And of course, one of the people he didn't mention in that was the founder of the mercenary army Blackwater, Eric Prince, who has a mercenary army there in the Emirates, working for the Chinese, but capable of creating mischief in that very volatile area where a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia is most certainly heating up. I mean, that much we can say, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And what's playing out is each side. I mean, I don't know if you can really boil it down to two sides, but you know, for the sake of simplicity, each side is trying to figure out how strong it is, and the difficulty for the rest of us is that the Gulf monarchs are not. They remind me kind of Rumsfeld in the early 2000s. They're just not good at seeing their limitations or seeing where they haven't made it as far as they think they can. And of course, these are powerful states, right? I mean, the Emirates and Saudi Arabia spend tons of money. In the case of the Emirates, they have quite a capable military, and they've been able to use that to effect in Libya, in Yemen, yes, in a nihilistic way, but effectively. So it's not that they're weak or marginal players. It's just that they aren't the dominant players, and they can't figure that out. They're very, very prone to delusion, and we see this in these conversations they have with Trump, where they say if you back up our approach, you'll get a friendly Middle East where Israel and these oil-rich Arab monarchies will do your bidding, and will run the table, will control the region. And Trump appears willing, or his advisors seem willing to believe some of that as well. And that is exceedingly dangerous because, you know, they're in their natural position now. As much power as they have now is sort of, I think, their maximum. And instead, they're reaching for some kind of, you know, sense of regaining lost influence from, you know, the era before the Iranian Revolution. And that's just never going to come back.
But given that you mentioned at the beginning, Athanasi Kambanis, that Hezbollah have played their hand well and Nasrallah's speech was very calming, they may be much, obviously they're much better at strategy and public relations than MBS is. But that's not to suggest that they're not without malevolence. I mean,
Absolutely not, right? So, I mean, not in no way do I intend to paint Iran as a stabilizing actor, right? I mean, they've been engaged in their own really destabilizing and dangerous moves. They've just been much smarter about it. So what we're talking about here is capability, strategic patience, and the intelligence to pursue your goals effectively. And I mean, in the case of Lebanon, it's really telling. Okay, Hezbollah is the group that essentially emerged dominant in the country and then chose to get involved in the civil war in Syria in a way that was incredibly destabilizing for Lebanon, put the country at risk of civil war. They ended up being the decisive interventionary power that kept the regime in Syria alive long enough to be bailed out ultimately by Russia. And they are, they're a sort of not overweening is the wrong word, but they are a bold, aggressive, maximalist actor. Now, they can get away with it because they're stronger. And they're smarter about how they do it. So each time they've pursued one of these further steps down the path of dominance, they do it with a little bit of balance and a little bit of leaving an escape hatch for themselves, so that if it doesn't work out, it's not a choice between, you know, blowing everything up or disappearing, or else winning everything. And that's why even you see this in the crisis that's playing out right now. The context here is that the Syrian war is ending, and it's ending in a victory for Hezbollah, Iran, and the regime. And so now, what is Hezbollah thinking about? Hezbollah is thinking about, how do we avoid a war with Israel? Because we know that Israel is thinking about war now as a sort of last chance while we're still occupied in Syria and distracted, with, you know, where a two-front war will be difficult. So they're trying to manage the situation in such a way that it avoids a war that would be destructive for them, while at the same time consolidating their victory in Syria and Lebanon. And for Hezbollah, there's many possible outcomes that are acceptable, whereas for their opponents, who feel like they've lost dignity as well as authority, and who are not smart political players, the only kinds of moves they can think about are impossible binary propositions, like finding a way to wipe out Hezbollah or disarm them, which isn't actually on the table.
Right, and into that mix is this relationship between MBS and Jared and Trump and the Saudi royals, and you just have to assume that a lot of money is changing hands there, and a lot of money is involved. And also, just to back on the Hezbollah-Iran question, Rafiq Harari, the prime minister, the father of the current Sayed, was assassinated by a massive car bomb in 2005, which five Hezbollah members were, the UN indicted five Hezbollah members. And now we're learning from the cache of secrets from bin Laden's lair in Pakistan, the relationship between al-Qaeda and Iran was much, much deeper than was previously thought. But at the end of the day, it does. What worries me, Athanasi, in the last seconds here, is that it's much more likely, I think, a war with Iran is much more likely. A U.S. war with Iran, or U.S. fingerprints on a war with Iran, is much more likely than even North Korea, because it just seems like we're stirring the pot, at least Trump's stirring the pot.
Yeah, and it's awful to find ourselves in a position of counting on restraint from Tehran or from Hezbollah as the thing that might save us from a war, you know, between Israel and Lebanon, or a wider war with America being involved in this kind of coalition, and in a way that would really hurt the region and would hurt American interests, right? A war that would not turn out in any possible outcome good for anyone's interests. And that's a bad hand to be relying on, for sure.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian. Take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who is in Beirut, Lebanon. He writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy. And his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining the new round of fratricide going on within the Democratic Party, prompted by the forthcoming book by former DNC chair Donna Brazile. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian. Good morning.
Good morning, David. And let's begin with this extraordinary puzzlement that I have about the Democrats, who are now entering a new round of fratricide with the forthcoming book by Donna Brazile, already creating tensions and reviving old wounds from the 2016 campaign. How is it that the losers in the Democratic Party, the serial losers of campaigns, are able to create lucrative and enduring careers as talking heads, etc.? Donna Brazile, of course, is she's famous for being Al Gore's presidential campaign manager, and her greatest achievement was that she brought Joe Lieberman on as the VP. We know what a great idea that was. Joe Lieberman just recently introduced your nemesis, the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, in her Senate hearings, her confirmation hearings. So that speaks volumes about Donna Brazile. It's a great choice with Joe Lieberman. Robbie Mook just lost. Bob Shrum's lost a couple of times. John Podesta just lost. Susan Estrich going back to Dukakis. And Mark Penn going back to Hillary 2008. So explain that to me. How can you make a lucrative career out of being losers, campaign losers?
The guy who cuts my hair asked me that about a month ago. He said, who was it that ran Hillary's campaign? He should never work again. And it's a very good question. I, as to Joe Lieberman, I can remember where I was. I was actually working in the White House when I heard that Al Gore had picked Joe Lieberman. For me, it was kind of like remembering where you were when President Kennedy was assassinated. I thought that was a disastrous decision. Yes, all of us do make bad decisions, but sometimes the losers have an interesting story to tell. And after all, the Democratic Party is one big circular firing squad, so we all enjoy the feeling of satisfaction when our fellow Democrats go down for a while. And so it's a terrible situation. I also lament that so many of the leaders of the Democratic Party and the top strategists spend all their time out of power lobbying for corporations and doing things to undermine what the Democrats supposedly stand for. So what you have a situation where you have a president with the lowest poll ratings in the history of poll taking, who's obviously incompetent, dangerous, disastrous, and yet the party can't even take advantage of it. We've got an election tomorrow or Tuesday in Virginia where somehow the party of Trump may actually take that governorship. So I'm at a loss to understand the incompetence. I think there is potentially a strong message for the Democratic Party that would align with the aspirations of the majority of voters, but they just don't seem to be able to rise to the occasion.
But if they lose on Tuesday in Virginia in the governor's race, where the Gillespie, who was used to be a reasonable Republican, has become a Trumpite or a Trumpista or whatever you call them, and has run a Trump campaign, slash and burn, horrible lies, venomous, disgusting. And the other guy, Northam, is running Hillary Clinton's campaign that she lost. So, and it's got people like Stan Greenberg, Bill Clinton's pollsters, tearing his hair out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know that Gillespie used to be a reasonable Republican. What he was a corporate lobbyist who represented all the interests of all the companies that really dominate Washington. And the truth is, the Trump administration, President Trump gets to star in his TV show and lash out at people and make his passive-aggressive complaints and his bigoted remarks. But in truth, who's really running the country is the Koch brothers and the lobbyists for all the special interests, because that no legislation is passing, but at the regulatory level, those people are getting all they want from people like Scott Pruitt, and President Trump barely knows it. So actually, Ed Gillespie would be a perfect addition as governor to the national tableau of Republican leaders, because the reason Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan don't really stand up to President Trump is because they, as the pay-to-play Republican Party, which stands for special interests, is getting most of what it wants out of a Trump presidency. So, yes, Gillespie kind of runs as a Trump Republican, but the other strain of the party, which is just a special interest strain, is just as bad. And the Democrats just don't seem to be able to put forth an agenda that actually conveys to working people, whether they're white people or people of color, that they are really the party that can help them.
Well, why is it, though, that we could spend hours talking about how they lost the coalition FDR put together and Bobby Kennedy championed, white working class, firemen, cops, workers, factory workers, all, and the people that Trump has now peeled off, along with the kind of urban professionals that Hillary Clinton's brought to the table. The big tent has shrunk. If they lose the governor's race in Virginia, it'll be a massive psychological blow. It'll be a massive victory for Trumpism. There's no question about it. 80% of the Republican Party support, or 80% of Republicans, I should say, completely support Trump at the moment. He's gone down a little bit. So we are in an alternative universe there. And even though, as you mentioned, the Congress or the Republicans in Congress are a bunch of coke whores, nevertheless, the whole point is that they are looking over their shoulder at being primaried, and that's why they're afraid of Trump, isn't it?
Yes, they are afraid of Trump. The Trump voters, I would say, most voters are middle class and working class people. There aren't that many rich people. Some of them love Trump because they love the bigotry. Some of them love the idea of draining the swamp. And, of course, Trump is doing the opposite of draining the swamp, staffing his administration with lobbyists and doing whatever the swamp people want him to do. And then another group, I'd say maybe the largest group, in fact, a lot of these people are not bigots, are people who've seen their factories shut down and their way of life go away and their jobs go away, and who believe Trump's lies that he actually cared about them. And those are the ones, along with some of the drain the swamp people, that the Democrats could be competitive with if they had the right message. Hillary Clinton actually more and more was pushed, moving towards the kind of policies that would help people like that, but she couldn't convey it because in her heart she wasn't there. And the Democratic Party is the Northeast Corridor, Acela Express party at this point, run by elites, people who live in cities like mine of Washington, D.C., and we're not going to get back to the Democrats, I shouldn't say we, are not going to get back to winning again unless they actually listen to and embrace and have solutions for the aspirations of those people and can show them that you have to be, for example, for clean energy, that there aren't the coal jobs aren't coming back. The jobs are in clean energy, and also the ability to have your home not swept away in a flood or a hurricane are in clean energy. So the policies are not so bad on the Democrat side, and I believe, actually, based on talking with Hillary transition people, that her policies would have been more progressive than you might have thought. But we're not. The Democrats are not conveying that. They are still the party that is getting that is not showing working people that it's the party for them.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And of course, I think the problem is, you know, the Democrats have pretty much always run on the idea that, you know, we may not be exciting, but the other guy's worse. And by the way, they'll put a bunch of fascists on the Supreme Court. That's still in play, but it's even worse now. There's so much of a dependence, it would seem, on the expectation and hope that Donald Trump will be impeached or will have a mental breakdown or something and carted off either in an orange jumpsuit or in a straitjacket. You know, you can't count on that, surely.
Well, I think Donald Trump is the most disgraceful president in our history. But frankly, it took me a while to come around to this. I think we're better off with Trump serving out his term, although I do believe he's clearly guilty of obstruction of justice and other impeachable offenses and should be impeached. But if Mike Pence were the president, I think that you could get those extra one or two votes to do all the destructive legislation that Trump is incapable of getting because he is always alienating one or two senators whom he needs. And you could repeal Obamacare with Mike Pence as president, and you could get a horrible tax bill that favors the rich with Mike Pence as president. So sad as it is, I think we're better off, you know, with this ugly, passive-aggressive but incompetent president for the next few years. But what we really need is a challenger. And let me say something about that, if you'll indulge me for 20 seconds. Any time Hillary or Bernie is mentioned on any social media that I look at, a fight breaks out. And that fight will never end. Hillary has said she's not going to run for president. As much as I admire Bernie Sanders, I wish he would say the same. Because if he gets the nomination, the Hillary people are going to sit it out. If he doesn't get the nomination, then the Bernie people are going to sit it out. And what I also will note is that no one has been elected president as a Democrat since 1948 who wasn't between the ages of 43 and 56 years old. I think we need a new generation of leadership here. We need to find someone who understands what the aspirations and can speak to working people, people of color, all the people that need to turn out and be excited about voting for Democrats in the next election. So I frankly think, I'm sorry for all the Bernie listeners out there, I think he should be a leader in the party but not run for the nomination because I think it's just going to lead to bad blood. And I would like to see a new crop of people compete to be president.
And also, just in looking at the political landscape ahead, the Republicans, Trump and company, have stolen working-class Democrats from the Democratic Party, and that's their new coalition, the Angry White Man Coalition. This has led to an alienation of centrists or center-right Republicans who... You could almost suggest the Democrats could win them over, but not if they move to the left, only if they move to the center. That's something else to consider. But just in closing, I mentioned, you know, the idea that Democrats, instead of having a narrative and a policy and a vision going forward, as they tear themselves apart with Donna Brazile, the serial loser, trying to sell a book, I mentioned the reliance on impeachment as opposed to a narrative. Impeachment looks a little closer, I must say, with the new revelations now coming out about the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's offshore ties to Putin's cronies and Milner's Facebook deal with the Russian bank, etc. What do you make of the latest breaking stories on the Russia probe?
I mean, Trump is all about Russia. He's lied about it from the beginning. There are so many connect arrows between Trump and Russia that, you know, it just never seems to end. There's no question that the Russians wanted Trump to win, that they offered dirt on Hillary, that Trump was interested in taking it, that he's looking for financial gain from his relations with Russia. It's all so obvious. And it's disgraceful, basically, that Putin has toyed with our country, and he wins either way. If Trump is the president, he's going to do Putin's bidding. And if Trump is paralyzed, then our country is paralyzed. It is a great tragedy, but I do believe our institutions, our judiciary, our law enforcement, our independent media, shows like yours, and enough people of goodwill are out there that we can hold this menace in check, get rid of Trump in 2020, if not sooner, and have we will survive this. I believe it. If I didn't believe it, I would just go fishing. But I'm working every day, try to be one of the many citizens who's fighting for our democracy. And I thank you, Ian, because you are too.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, though, it does seem that that we shouldn't be despondent. I mean, covering Trump is like a daily dose of doom. But when you look at the figures, he's between 30% and 40% popularity, and it keeps going down. I think it's somewhere between 30% and 35% now. Just the math, simple math, would tell you that maybe there's a 65% majority out there. Why can't the Democrats seize the majority?
Well, I think they've done a pretty good job at preventing Trump from doing anything legislatively. And they can't do anything about all the regulations that are passing. They can't seize the majority because they can't agree, and because everybody's about themselves and not about pulling together, and because there actually are genuine policy differences within the Democratic coalition. But when you have the right candidate, and not everybody loved Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, but when you have a candidate who is strong and can project, then you can at least have a not Republican in the White House. And I think we could do it again in 2020. I think it's about a 51% chance that Trump will not be reelected or Pence will not be elected. So I think we've got a shot, but it's got to be about thinking creatively about how we pull this coalition together. It's got to be progressive, because that's the only way you inspire the working people and the people of color and everybody else to come out and vote. I honestly think it can be done, but people have to get a lot smarter and care a lot less about themselves and a lot more about the country.
But just in the last minute, both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, during their administrations, the Democratic Party was eviscerated at the congressional and the state level. They lost thousands and thousands of seats. So what's the problem there, and what's the connection there?
The connection is that it's got to not just be that people tried to do hard things at the beginning of their terms. There's no doubt about it, and that can be unpopular. So you've got to move ahead with progressive policies, but you've also got to continue the political effort to create the support for it. I honestly believe that for the things most important to this country, about jobs, the economy, healthcare, that we do have a progressive coalition in this country about how people really feel. And we just have to pull it together.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay. Take care, Ian. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern as a senior fellow at Republican Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign and White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.